Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 COGO. I'm Andrea Lopez Villafana, managing editor at Voice of San Diego. I'm joined this week by education reporter Jacob McWinney. What's up, Jacob?
Hey there, Andrea. You know, I got to say, I appreciate that you don't sound like a livestock auctioneer when you read that intro. Scott has this tendency of reading it literally as fast as, you know, his mouth can move. And for whatever reason, that just kind of pains me.
You know? I got to breathe in between.
I don't think it shows proper deference to News Radio 600 COGO.
And we're also joined by senior investigative reporters Lisa Halverstadt and Will Huntsberry. What's up, guys?
Hey, what I up? Won't say anything about Scott.
Jacob took all the room for takes, so.
What can I say? I'm a take machine.
Coming up on the show this week, we have updates from the highly anticipated safe camping site. The city of San Diego opened the site to provide homeless folks a safe place to camp. Remember, this is all tied to the city's new ban on camping. The city is preparing to crack down on tents later this month. Lisa will share what she's learned so far. She also has a new story about racial disparities in homeless enforcement. She'll explain the numbers and what advocates are saying. And of course, the other side of the homeless crisis is housing. Will reported this week on a project that could have housed many in need, but one wealthy family and their 100-year-old company blocked it. He'll lay out that story for us. Finally, San Diego Unified is facing a big budget deficit. We'll dig into the district's finances and what's hitting them hardest. That's all coming up. Stay with us. But first, wow, what a roller coaster. San Diego State. I know you've compared this to a relationship, Jacob, but I kind of think it's like Mean Girls.
Mean Girls, yeah. Well, if it's like Mean Girls, the Mountain West definitely has written SDSU in its burn book, for sure, 100%. And that's kind of the situation right now. There are lots of question marks. Essentially, for people who weren't paying attention, San Diego State has long flirted with joining a power conference. Pac-12 seemed like the obvious one. And it was sort of wanting to leave the Mountain West Conference, which was sort of a, you know, smaller conference that didn't have this sort of media rights deal money, didn't have the sort of exposure that a Pac-12, for example, would give them. And there had long been rumors linking San Diego State to the Pac-12 because, you know, let's be honest, the sports in San Diego State are amazing. And they've kind of long been viewed as the kind of shining star of the Mountain West.
Yeah.
And so long story short, there are all these back and forth between the Mountain West and San Diego State, with San Diego State initially submitting a letter saying, hey, we're thinking about leaving.
Sort of considering, like, yeah, would you be open to changing some terms of,
yes,
our agreement?
Exactly.
You know?
We're thinking of leaving.
Probably on the way out.
Probably on the way out. But this is a long-term thing, right? Can we, yeah, figure out a way to extend this deadline so that we don't have to pay this inflated exit fee? And Mountain West responded basically saying, nah, dog, you're out.
And pay us, give us the money.
Yeah, give us the money. You now owe $17 million, or you will owe $17 million in an exit fee if you don't leave by this date. What was really tough for San Diego State is they had not yet received an invitation from the Pac-12. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of like jumping out of this plane without a parachute. Now obviously they still have a year to be in the Mountain West Conference, but beyond that, it's really unclear what's happening.
Was that always the case that, like, even when they first sent the letter, like, we think we want to break up, that it still meant they'd play in Mountain West this year?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Somebody, you know, don't get too mad at me if I have that wrong. All you sports geeks out there. But that's my understanding. Yeah. No, I love you, but I am terrified of you.
He wants to be one of you.
And so at this point, basically what has happened was Mountain West Conference, or the San Diego State, sent a letter to the Mountain West saying, hey guys, you know, we're not leaving after all. Like, isn't that great?
We want to stay. Yeah.
Let's stay. Let's hug it out. And Mountain West Conference came back again with a nah, dog, you're out. And now you owe us $17 million. And mm-hmm. we're going to withhold this money from the media distribution deal that you already are a part of. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And I don't think it's very clear.
And I'm curious because they removed, Mountain West removed San Diego State's president, Adela de la Torre, from their board.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so do they stay that year and she's has like no say?
I guess so.
Lots of nerdy questions to this like sports story.
It's going to be rough too because, you know, they have such a high winning percentage in the Mountain mm-hmm. West. So Mountain West is mad at them, but are they still going to go in and crush all the other Mountain West teams this year? Is this going to deflate their ego or inflate their ego?
Well, I mean, if anything, I think that now San Diego State has something to prove, right?
Yeah.
They want to be as attractive as possible
revenge
to these other
body.
Conferences. Yeah. Yeah. They have to get in revenge shape, you know. The breakup body is coming.
Nice.
And so I mean, we'll see. There are high hopes, I know, at least from me, about what the basketball team will look like next year.
Is this a case of it's going to blow, you know, the theory of San Diego that everything's about to get big and then it doesn't get big, you know, San Diego's just always tripping over its own shoestrings. Mm-hmm. Is this just another instance of that where potentially it's going to get worse throughout the year?
Certainly that's what Scott sort of posited, when we talked about this recently, and I think it's possible, but more than anything, I think this is just a sort of wait and see moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as somebody who was born and raised in San Diego, and as a kid went to Aztecs games, you know, Godspeed, good luck.
And also this week, Mayor Todd Gloria had a press conference, and Lisa, you were there.
I was there. So the mayor on Thursday morning had a press conference and he talked about the new safe campsite that has opened at 20th and B Streets, which folks may be aware, it's at the edge of Balboa Park. It's a city operations yard. So far, 20 people and 14 tents are there.
Mm-hmm.
And he emphasized that this is better than the options on the street, and that other cities are not doing this. And that was really a reaction to a lot of blowback from advocates who've been concerned that maybe the city rushed this and really wasn't ready to accommodate folks.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely, you know, he came in trying to talk about the different amenities that are there. For example, he talked about meals, the restrooms that are there, hand washing stations, shade canopies, because there was a concern that you know, folks are literally on the asphalt in these tents, and how would they deal with the heat? Mm-hmm. He talked about the fact that there's, you know, connections to services and other things there. He talked also about the fact that they're really slowly ramping this up. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, there was a thought because, you know, this could accommodate 136 tents that boom, you know, doors are going to open. Yeah. People are going to flood in. But the provider has chosen to instead take in three new people mm-hmm. each day to try to ramp it up more slowly. And the mayor said that that's by design. As they're trying to figure this out and bring more people in, they want to make sure that they have the necessary amenities and that they're able to adjust as needed.
So this, I think part of the concerns, right, that it was rushed. Let's go back a bit. So the safe lots, I remember when you like overheard it at a community meeting, they were considering a different lot at the time, Inspiration Point and Buffalo Park. But this is all tied to the camping ban.
It is, mm-hmm. but it's interesting because, you know, the city has this concept, I guess, to take a step back, this concept has been talked about for a long time. Mm-hmm. In San Diego, before the camping ban came forward, had looked at doing something like this. And in fact, in 2017, during the hepatitis A outbreak, they had a safe campsite at 20th and B, which is the same site we're talking about. But efforts to do that again, you know, moved really slowly. The mayor didn't love the idea. You know, there was lots of talk of what locations they should go with, what provider would handle it, and they were really struggling to get things together. But the camping ban seemed to be a real impetus to actually move it forward quickly mm-hmm. And actually deliver. Mm-hmm. For folks that don't listen to the podcast every week.
Boo.
So we've been talking about this one a lot. But the camping ban essentially bars folks from setting up their tents on public property when there's shelter available. But as we've reported extensively, there's often not shelter available. So that's a big hurdle for the city. But it also bans camping within two blocks of shelters and schools, in certain parks, major transit hubs along waterways at all times, even when there's not shelter available. And so as part of that discussion, when Councilmember Stephen Whitburn, who represents downtown, brought forward this concept, he said it was extremely important to also provide places for people to go. And he really championed this safe sleeping concept that some folks might be hearing about now. And just to give a little more context on, you know, what we're talking about with the safe camping site, this is essentially a place where the city is actually setting up tents and people are able to stay in those tents. And then there are other services that are there. So, for example, there are restrooms. You know, there are there's transportation if people need to get to an appointment or something. They have meals. They're working out a solution for mobile showers so that mm-hmm. people could take a shower there. So really, it's about allowing people to be in tents rather than have them in that traditional congregate shelter that I think a lot of us, you know, historically have been fixated on in mm-hmm. San Diego.
Can we go back to the three people for a minute? You know, they're moving in three new people a day or a week?
A day.
And so, you know, people seem to be a little, some people at least, maybe in the activist community, seem to be a little frustrated with the rollout at first. Now they're saying this is three people a day by design. You know, I wonder if they stepped into this a little bit by, you know, I don't remember them telling us it was going to be a slow rollout a week ago when they announced it. They just announced, we're opening to great fanfare. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute, we're actually going to open very slowly, which maybe is a great idea, but I'm not sure the community was like prepared for it to work that way.
Yeah, if the messaging had been, we're going to open the safe lots, the plan is to, you know, do three intakes a day, and here's why, and this is what we're going to do, and maybe by what date we hope to get to X amount of people.
No, but instead, you know, it was what Lisa was just talking about with the ban. You know, I've heard people kind of use this hands metaphor a lot mm-hmm. when they're talking about it, like services, we're offering services with one hand. And if that's not working and you're not taking that, then we're doing enforcement. Right. And that's how these things are supposed to play together. So this is supposed to be like the big service offering.
So I will say there's definitely been some messaging challenges here. But on the day of the opening, I did talk to somebody from the Homelessness Solutions and Strategies Department, and they said, yes, it's going to be a slow ramp up. But I don't really think that's been effectively communicated to the community. Mm-hmm. And really, there has been confusion about how folks get in. So I've been fielding a lot of questions from both unhoused people and advocates about how they can get in.
Yeah, how do they get in?
So the way that this is working is they have to be working with an outreach worker. Mm-hmm. And outreach workers have been working on sort of assembling lists of people that they've gotten to know who really, for various reasons, didn't want to go to congregate shelter. Mm-hmm. And so those are the first folks that are being offered to come in. So today I actually asked a question at the press conference, how can folks get in who aren't connected to an outreach worker? Because I'm sure getting that question a lot. And the response I got is they should call 211 and then they can be connected with an outreach worker. I do want to say caveat real quick that I have heard a slew of complaints about 211 over the years. And I have heard that there's been some initial confusion around, you know, whether 211 is aware or actually able to place people here. So I think there's still a lot that's being figured out in terms of how these intakes are working. I think, you know, the city's now much more aware because of advocates of some of these challenges. And this is something I do want to continue to monitor.
Well, that's the thing about the rollout, right, in terms of messaging what it was going to be like when this opened. Because the other thing I think we've seen this past week is people tweeting about people showing up and trying to get a spot and they can't. And they're just like being told to call 211, you know. So if you've walked across downtown to get to this place on the edge of Balboa Park and then, you know, it can't, if they're only letting in three a day and that's being managed by caseworkers, then by default, calling 211 is going to get you nothing in terms of getting in that day. I think we can say that pretty safely.
Likely, yes. I do think that as it you know, develops, I think there probably will be some more clarity and outreach workers will be communicating to more people about it. But yeah, I mean, I do think we also have to say 136 spaces, you know, maybe to some people sounds like a lot. It's not. That is going to fill up really quickly. I know, you know, Jacob was out on the street recently talking to folks and heard this as well. I certainly have heard, like, there are a lot of people that are very interested in something like this. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot more people that are interested than they have space for.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing related to all of this, this camping ban is likely to fuel more police interactions. And you had a story this week that those police interactions would increase with Black San Diegans, because according to the latest census numbers, 6% of the city's population is Black, but Black San Diegans make up 27% of the unsheltered population. That's according to the latest annual homeless census count. So Lisa, your story lays out kind of a possibility that city council members and advocates are worried about. What are they saying?
I mean, what we're talking about is that there's, you know, if you're a Black San Diegan, you are disproportionately likely to be homeless, and you're also disproportionately likely to be affected by enforcement. Mm-hmm. And so I had done an analysis of encroachment enforcement. Now, encroachment is basically blocking a sidewalk. It's the primary tool that the police now use to address homelessness. And what I found is that from 2018 through last month, or actually through May, mm-hmm. I can't believe we're already in July, that 28% of the citations and arrests were given to Black people. And I think that's really significant and speaks to the concerns that some folks have, both in the advocate community and on the city council. Mm-hmm. There's a concern that we already know that Black San Diegans are disproportionately likely to be homeless and to be affected by enforcement. And so if you have a new enforcement tool, it's likely that they are going to be disproportionately impacted by that as well. And the encroachment numbers do bear that out. Mm-hmm. They're concerned too about, you know, what are the impacts of these encounters, right? So how might, you know, that encounter, you know, might mean that somebody has a harder time getting off the street, or maybe that they're less likely to accept services And so there was quite a tense discussion at city council when they voted on the camping ban because of the concerns surrounding this.
Right. And you had someone in your story who felt, you know, there's the argument of like bias here with police officers. And you had someone in your story who personally experienced something that, you know, led to them being disconnected with the, you know, resource that he was connecting with to, you know, eventually move off the street.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about Anthony. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, Anthony's number has changed, so I wasn't able to get in touch with him. This is really common for folks who live on the street. It can be hard to stay in touch. But I was talking to Anthony quite a bit last year after an encounter that he had at Balboa Park that just really traumatized him. He ended up just fleeing that area because he was so concerned about running into the police again and potentially being arrested. And as you pointed out, he ended up losing contact with the service provider that was coming to that area of Balboa Park to try to help him. Mm-hmm. And he actually lost contact with them for weeks. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, you know, he popped up again. One thing that I didn't mention in the story is he said to me, and this just always sticks with me since this conversation, is he said, you know, sometimes I just have to remind myself that I'm a person. Mm-hmm. And I think that just really speaks to the fact that he felt like he was being treated as a pest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly, you know, felt that quote. Perhaps his race was part of the story there.
Yeah. What did the police say in response to concerns from advocates that, you know, this will affect Black San Diegans disproportionately in the topic of bias?
So they say that this isn't a bias issue. Mm-hmm. They point out that, you know, the unsheltered population, 27% of it is Black San Diegans, and that their citations, the 28% that I cited earlier, kind of line up. And mm-hmm. so that speaks to, you know, not a disproportionate impact when you look at the homeless population specifically. But they do say if there are concerns that people have about bias, they want to hear about them and that they are trying to, you know, make sure officers receive training. So every 2 years, they're receiving anti-bias training and that this is something they're talking about on a regular basis. But certainly, I think, you know, what can't be missed is that, you know, whether the police might argue that there's not a bias issue, there are a lot of people that feel that there's a bias issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, had a conversation with the police captain I quoted in the story, and we were just talking about how, you know, sometimes what happens in one of these encounters, it can be really hard to prove, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that the person didn't feel something. And certainly I've talked to a lot of people over the years who have felt that their race played a role in how they were treated in an encounter with a police officer.
So obviously the city council had a pretty, you know, tense moment in that meeting. What was the result of the conversation that they were having about race and enforcement and what they were hoping to change?
So Council President Sean Elo Rivera wanted to add an amendment to the ordinance to track all stops related to this encampment ban. And the police came back and said, well, we can't really do that. And Council Member Stephen Whitburn requested a break so that they could sort of talk about this. And when mm-hmm. they came back from the break, there was a really tense exchange with Council Member Monica Montgomery Stepp, who was concerned, like, are you guys trying to just like not track this? Like, mm-hmm. what's going on? And there was further conversation about it. The police said, well, you know, we can't actually track stops. I won't get into the weeds on why that is, but they said they couldn't actually track stops, but they could provide monthly reports tracking actual enforcement and provide a breakdown of the races of folks that received tickets.
This is citations.
Or arrests, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so they will, going forward, the city council approved that amendment to provide monthly reports tracking enforcement and providing racial data. And so Council President Elo Rivera said to me, you know, that it's his hope that by at least tracking this and being aware of it, police and the city will do all that they can to avoid this disproportionate impact that they're very concerned about.
So another thing that came up during this morning press conference on Thursday was the mayor talked about a story that our Will Huntsbury had this week about a wealthy family and their company and how they're blocking a new housing project.
Yes, yes. He weighed in on it. I heard he gave it a lot of clarity.
He made sure we had credit.
Well, I appreciate that.
So, Will, tell us, what did you find?
Well, like you said, I'll back up even further than what you said. The city has been trying to buy extended stay motels around town for quite some time with state money called home key money. And they're trying to buy these extended stay motels to permanently house homeless people. I heard that they had their eyes on one and it was getting blocked. And it was getting blocked by this 100-year-old San Diego company, maybe the oldest San Diego company still in existence, a powerhouse of Southern California development, H.G. Fenton. I had heard that they were blocking this deal. And long story short, I found out that was true.
Okay, so who is H.G. Fenton?
H.G. Fenton, the company started in 1906. It was started by this man named Henry G. Fenton. Like I said, they're big in development now, and they have lots of developments across Southern California. But in 1906, Henry G. Fenton he started as a ranch hand in the San Pasqual Valley when he was 7 years old.
Nice.
Moved here with his mom.
A little bit
of
history here.
Yeah, yeah. Quick little history lesson. And he ended up basically getting some contracts for public improvements. Like he paved a lot of the streets in Coronado. He built this jetty that extends off Coronado. He worked on the Tijuana racetrack. He was involved in all these early infrastructure projects across the city. And he also started buying up huge chunks of land, mm-hmm. ranches and quarries. I told you he used to be a ranch hand. He was into that whole ranch thing. And so he died around 1950-ish. And after that, the H.G. Fenton Company began developing all this land he had bought. And, they kept those quarries running for a while and those ranches. But eventually they put all that away and they said, we're only going to do real estate and development. And one of the key places they wanted to develop, they called Mission Valley Heights. Mm-hmm. It's in Mission Valley, just north of the 8, and it's where this extended stay motel is. So they had all these plots of land there, and they started something called a covenant, which our listeners may or may not be. A covenant. Covenants are kind of like homeowners association rules. Mm-hmm. Basically, anybody who bought a plot of land in Mission Valley Heights from H.G. Fenton had to sign on to this covenant. And it had all these restrictions in it, including that there could be no subsidized housing. So, that means the home key program. That means the government housing people. Mm-hmm. They sold a chunk of land, Extended Stay America bought it, but Extended Stay America had to sign on to the covenant. Mm-hmm. Extended Stay America decides they're down to sell to the city. The city decides they want to buy it. This place has 140 rooms, so, you're talking, it could house a couple hundred people at least, mm-hmm. in those rooms. So when the city goes to make the purchase, they find out about this covenant, and it needless to say, throws a wrench in the whole thing. the city asked H.G. Fenton to change the covenant. They had the power to do that, but H.G. Fenton was like, nah, dog, we're not doing it. We're not changing it. Not a chance.
Is a covenant that denies the ability to create affordable housing on a plot of land, is that even legal? I feel like that would be something that at this point, as we're trying to develop everything because of our crazy housing shortage, that just would not be allowed.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And other people ask me that too. Like, how can you block something from happening on a piece of land that's not yours?
Yeah.
Because the zoning doesn't preclude that, right? Anybody who wants to build something, they have to stick in with the city zoning laws. You know, the projects have to conform to that. Mm-hmm. But this was just like a private contract between different parties who own, you know, a big chunk of land together. And long story short, it's questionable whether you can do that. Some people say you can do that. Some people say you can't do that. The state of California actually specifically wrote a law 2 years ago that said people could get these covenants struck down. So the city could have tested that. The city did have a legal tool at their disposal to try to overturn this covenant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the home key funds do have a tight deadline to get them, and it's just weeks away. And so basically the city's response to me was, you know, we think this law is questionable, number one. We're not even sure it holds up in court. And number two, like, it's just going to be too much of a logistical challenge for us to try to fight this.
Yeah. So at the press conference on Thursday morning, I asked the mayor about this. And, you know, his response was basically, you know, we'll seek every opportunity we have to try to get affordable housing. But this deadline is just a problem. And we need to meet this deadline. He threw in a little bit of a jab about some previous reporting that Jacob and I did about the city in the past missing an initial deadline, city and county, all the cities actually in the county missing an initial deadline at an easy crack at some money. And he said that, you know, we want to meet the deadline this time. We want to get the money. I did note to him that, you know, he could take this to court. He didn't seem too excited about that.
Let's play the clip.
The property that you're referring to is one that had been identified as a potential option for a home key application. When we did our due diligence, we discovered that there are covenants recorded against that property that prohibit property in that area of Mission Valley being used for affordable housing. We had some conversations with the association that monitors or enforces those covenants, and we did not receive a favorable response when asking if they might consider changing those.
I think it's very fair on the city's part to point out that, like, there were very difficult timeline problems at stake here. But I think, you know, we would also be remiss to not point out how powerful H.G. Fenton is. You know?
Well, that part where he said we did not receive a favorable response. I think the quote in your story captured how powerful and how unfavorable that response was. You want to read it? It's pretty good.
Yeah. So the mayor said it a little diplomatically there. Walter Spaeth, an attorney for the San Diego Housing Commission, said the response was absolutely not, and we're going to do whatever we can to stop it. They have deep pockets, and we have every reason to believe they were not bluffing. So that's basically what H.G. Fenton said to the suggestion that they change their covenant.
So H.G. Fenton, we're talking like Fenton Parkway.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking like, I don't know if we'd call him a founding father of San Diego, but certainly a power player in its early development. And, you know, for that matter, the company's still very powerful today. You know, they spend a lot of time lobbying City Hall. They have been involved in the building association here and running it for many years. So, you know, not only that, they've spent a lot of time raising money for Todd Gloria. They've donated a lot of money to Todd Gloria. So these are people who are talking to him and his staff members all the time. They're raising money for him, and they are very opinionated when it comes to development. And their opinion in this case won out, and you know, that was perhaps aided by the timeline at play.
Is it true that there already are homeless folks staying in this extended stay hotel?
Well, yes, it is. That was a deep irony of reporting this story, is that there are actually homeless people staying there now. And various programs have been funding homeless people to stay in this extended motel as far back as COVID. And so Spaeth, the housing commission attorney, he told me that that is something that would have played in the city's favor, right? That because something that matters in court is not just that you have a contract on paper, but how you enforce that contract on a day-to-day basis. And if you've never been enforcing the contract, you have a much weaker argument that your contract is really at play.
Mm-hmm. So what happens now?
Did he shed any light on that whatsoever, Lisa? I think Lisa kind of tried to ask him what happens now today.
Well, it's unclear, you know, what the future prospects for this hotel purchase are. He said that they're very focused on, you know, finishing the due diligence for the other two hotels that they're still looking at. And they already submitted a home key application for two other sites. Mm-hmm. So they're now pretty focused on moving forward with the others.
But these, you know, these they've had multiple motels in the works throughout. But it's definitely worth noting that even if they get these two, you know, they've been shifting motels in and out as it goes along as they try to figure out which motels will work for them. But, you know, the maximum beds they're going to get has certainly now been decreased, not exactly by 140, but close to 100. You know, even if they get everything they want at this point, you know, Fenton will have, you know, certainly had its way in making sure that there are going to be less permanent housing units available in the future. And, you know, you can feel about that however you want to. You know, maybe you think that's great. You know, some people are very anti-housing first these days, right? Or you can think it's a tragedy that this corporation had this influence. The fact of the matter is they had it. There will be less beds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's important to keep track of.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's connect this back to our earlier discussion about the safe campsite. And, you know, certainly the mayor has talked about adding additional shelter. If you don't have places for people to go from these safe campsites or the shelters or the safe campsites become permanent destinations, which they were never intended to be. Mm-hmm. And so earlier this year, I had reported on the fact that at that time, just 11% of people who were exiting shelters were moving into permanent housing. And there were people that were waiting a really long time in shelters for housing. And at the time, the Housing Commission told me that they were essentially in a resource desert. You know, they didn't have housing options for folks to the degree that they needed them. And this home key application was really seen as a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so now there's just going to be a bit fewer. At least we know for sure because they have to apply to get the money and move forward with the purchases. But we know that there are going to be fewer resources than they hoped there would be. Thankfully, I'm happy to report the shelter outcomes have gotten a little bit better recently. About 15% of people exiting shelters in more recent history have been moving into homes. Mm-hmm. But I think anybody who looks on our streets right now can see that we need a lot more places for people to be.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
The budget for San Diego Unified's current school year was approved by the board in June. But during that meeting, officials projected a big deficit coming in the 2024-2025 school year. They say the deficit could be as big as $128 million. And they said it could get bigger the year after that, potentially over $180 million. So, Jacob, our education reporter, how does the district explain all of this?
Well, they basically explain it by saying it's tough times, right? State funding for education has decreased in the latest budget. There have been a couple iterations. You know, the first budget was pretty great for education officials, but then the May revise came out and it was not very great for education.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and the most recent budget put some money back into schools' coffers, but was still less than the original.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one big factor in all of this, mm-hmm. right? That what the state is awarding schools. A second big factor is, as we've come out of COVID, we have seen not only the enrollment decline that public schools have long seen speed up. Mm-hmm. So there are fewer kids in our schools now by quite a lot than there were before the pandemic. And that enrollment decline is projected to continue. We don't see that slowing down much at all. In addition to that, average daily attendance has also declined, right? We've seen this explosion in chronic absenteeism, as I've reported, and average daily attendance is another factor when the state is determining how much funding each school gets. Mm-hmm. But there are also other costs. You know, the district recently approved a new contract with the teachers union,
mm-hmm.
that will see a 10% retroactive raise back to July 2020 and a 5% raise going forward after this, starting next school year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting. It does seem, I think for a lot of people, like really kind of crazy that the district would approve these big budget these big pay increases for teachers mm-hmm. at a time when they are also projecting a budget deficit. So just to put in context what these numbers look like, just the retroactive pay increase back to July 2022 will cost around $130 million the district projects,
mm-hmm.
and the entire budget deficit for which they are projecting for the 24-25 school year is around $128.9 million. Now, granted, this increase in pay is happening, you know, retroactively, whereas this budget deficit will be happening not this coming school year, but the school year after that. And as you said, the district is projecting things to get bleaker on down the line,
mm-hmm.
With an increase to $182 million budget deficit mm-hmm. In the 25-26 school year.
What do school district officials say about, you know, just making that decision about raising salaries for employees?
Well, they basically say they have no choice, right? Mm-hmm. They say that they needed to increase pay in order to retain and recruit the highest quality teachers, administrators, and staff that they need to run the district. You know, with increased cost of living, they said essentially they were between a rock and a hard place. They had to increase this pay, and if they didn't, then they would be without staff and teachers. So, you know, I think we still have to wait to see how that shakes out. But it's definitely a pretty bleak time. Now, I will say the district has been in budget holes of a similar size to this in the past. For example, they projected a $124 million budget hole for the 2017-2018 school year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back then, the district resorted to layoffs. It seems around nearly 200 employees were laid off. The exact number, it was kind of hard to come by. But school officials say that for the 24-25 budget deficit that they are projecting, they are confident they won't have to lay people off. Again, I think it's too early to tell, but they have put forth a bunch of strategies that they say will help them plug this giant hole,
mm-hmm.
Which include trying to increase average daily attendance. Again, ADA is one of the big things that the state factors in when determining how school districts get funded. They hope to lean in to UTK enrollment, as I have previously reported.
Yeah.
They see UTK as a way to increase, you know, enrollment over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
They also are batting around programmatic cuts here and there. And you know what? I'm realizing now that I didn't mention one big factor in all of this, which is that $160 million that the district was receiving, these federal COVID relief funds for schools are expiring after this next school year. So that's another huge reason why all of this is happening for the district.
So I have to ask, because I know some of our listeners will wonder, I mean, year after year, or election cycle after election cycle, San Diego Unified has gotten bond measures through.
Mm-hmm.
Are these helping at all, or?
Well, the way you have to understand bond measures is that bond measures are a pot of money for a very specific type of thing, right? So the district can, and districts across the state can use bond measures to, say, build a school, or to buy computers, or to buy iPads, or, as Voice of San Diego has reported in the past, buy faulty sports fields, right? But unfortunately, they can't shift this money over into their general operation funds, right? So you can't pay a teacher, you can't pay a nurse, you can't use any of this on staffing. And so unfortunately for the district, these two pots of money are just are separate, and they cannot dip into that in order to, you know, make up for holes in their operating budget.
I thought Cody Pedersen's quote about, like, going forward with this budget situation was so good. This is a roadmap for sweating. We're going to have to sweat a bit.
Yeah, I appreciate Cody's quotes. He's a good talker.
I guess my reaction as somebody who also covered education a little bit, there were the layoffs that you mentioned at San Diego Unified. I also covered Sweetwater Union and a financial crisis they had. And, you know, they had, you know, a lot of people get up in arms about these raises, right? Mm-hmm, and, you know, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, I'll put that to the side. But here are the facts I know about Sweetwater. You know, they had talked about raises, and the state told them if you do, or the county told them if you do these raises, it's going to be disastrous. They did the raises, and then
nice,
they...
That's always a good sign. Disastrous.
And then they end up covering up their budget hole. You know, they hid their budget hole that created, and, you know, then they got slapped by the SEC after we covered it for a couple of years because they were, you know, making all these financial disclosures that were false. I guess I'm saying the balancing act is that, yeah, you definitely have to attract talent. That is correct. And I think they're right about that. But, like, if you are the union officials pushing for those raises, you also have to know it is a possibility that there could be layoffs later if you push too hard on the raises.
Yeah.
Like, if the union officials get 15% now, which they got, and then it turns out that wasn't sustainable, then some of their, like, union brothers and sisters are going to get laid off. And that is got to be a tricky place to be in.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And you know, from what I understand, I think that there was some transparency about all of this when contract negotiations were happening. The district says that they have a whole year to figure out where these cuts are coming from. They aren't under, you know, any illusion that this is going to be easy, but they are confident that they can balance their budget again. I mean, that's all to be seen. But they say that there are options, and right now they're hoping to not resort to kind of the least appetizing option, which is laying folks off.
Well, you can follow Jacob's reporting and subscribe to his newsletter at vosd.org/learning. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. Keep up with all our news updates and big stories with The Morning Report, our most popular product. Subscribe at vosd.org/morning. That's vosd.org/morning. I'm Andrea Lopez Villafana, managing editor at Voice of San Diego. Jacob McWinney is our education reporter. Will Huntsberry and Lisa Halberstadt are our senior investigative reporters. Nate John is our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.